You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of December 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's news agenda with Tanya Filer, visiting research scholar at the Universidad de San Andrés in Buenos Aires. Tanya, what have you got for us?
Today we'll be looking at the 30th anniversary of democracy in Argentina. Then we'll be looking at continued concerns over press censorship in Venezuela. And finally, an America's perspective on the funeral today of Nelson Mandela.
More from Tanya a little later on in the program. Also, we unpack U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel's visit to Pakistan and his meeting with Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif with Samira Shackle here in the studio.
And as the Kremlin closes, venerable Russian news agency RIA Novosti, we ask to whom Vladimir Putin thinks he needs to demonstrate his power.
RIA Novosti has always been viewed by members of Putin's increasingly radical inner circle as being a Medvedev project. And you would catch yourself thinking, if the country gets even more authoritarian, this is not going to last. And duly, it hasn't.
Plus, we sent Monocle correspondent Barrett Austin to a very sunny and tropical locale. We'll hear his report from Design Miami.
The Design Miami is unique in the sense that it's the only fair entirely dedicated to collectible design and really covering the entire spectrum of the 20th and the 21st century.
All that plus, we'll review the morning's papers with Monocle's Alexa Firminich. We'll check in with our woman in Athens and we'll play some music too. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So a very busy Tuesday edition of the programme. Before we get started, here is Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
A memorial service for Nelson Mandela gets underway in an hour's time. Huge crowds have gathered at a stadium near Soweto to remember South Africa's first black president. Thousands queued through the night, hoping for a seat at the service.
I've got here since 3 a.m. earlier in the morning. I woke up here to be in funeral for Mandela. And, you know, the father of Africa, and we have to be unity in Africa. That is why I'm here today.
I came here early in the morning, about 3 o'clock. I hear to respect Tata Madiba.
I feel like I can cry, but I'm celebrating inside my heart.
Dozens of world leaders and other dignitaries will be there, including President Obama and the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Four of Mr. Mandela's grandchildren are to speak at the service, as well as a fellow prisoner from Robben Island. While millions are expected to watch around the world, 95,000 will witness the service inside the stadium.
Alala Mandela, rest in peace.
I'm going to heaven to pay my last respect to Nelson Mandela. It was an awesome person, father of freedom. He made a very good contribution to our freedom in this country. Without him, I don't know where will this country be.
Two French soldiers have been killed in the Central African Republic. They've been shot dead days after France stepped up its deployment in the country. 1,600 French soldiers are there to try to disarm militia groups after a surge in violence. Last week, 400 people were killed in fighting around the capital, Bangui. Thailand's Prime Minister has appealed to anti-government demonstrators to play a part in snap elections in February. Yingluck Shinawat dissolved parliament on Monday after sustained protests against her, but she has rejected demands that she should immediately stand down, saying she'll remain as caretaker Prime Minister until the poll takes place. Her opponents say her government's being controlled by her brother, the exiled former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat. The mayor of the Colombian capital, Bogotá, has been sacked and banned from holding public office for 15 years. Gustavo Petro, a former member of an armed rebel group, claims he's the victim of a coup designed to stop him standing for president next year. Officials say he's mismanaged the running of Bogotá's rubbish collection system. Ukraine's president, Viktor Yanukovych, is to hold talks with his three predecessors to try to end the protests against his government. Last week, they backed demonstrators who'd taken to the streets after a trade deal with the European Union was abandoned in favor of closer ties with Russia. Anti-government activists have been barricading a protest camp in Kiev, fearing riot police could move to break up the gathering. The US Secretary of State has insisted Iran will not be allowed to develop nuclear weapons. John Kerry has rejected Israeli criticism of the deal agreed with Tehran at talks with world powers. Iran will get limited sanctions relief in return for scaling down uranium enrichment work and giving international inspectors greater access. Mr. Kerry insists it's a good deal for all parties.
We will not allow Iran to acquire a nuclear weapon, not now, not ever. And I promise you that. I can't stand here today and tell you that the Iranians are going to do what they need to do. But I do know that Israel is actually safer today than it was the day before we made the deal.
Meanwhile, Iran has reached agreement with Pakistan to speed up a gas pipeline project. It's designed to deliver Iranian gas to consumers across South Asia, but the US has opposed its construction, arguing it could violate sanctions against Iran. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Paul, thank you very much. It is 6 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. It is 7 minutes past the hour. It's time now to set the agenda with the top stories you'll need to know today. We're joined now by Tanya Filer, visiting research scholar at the Universidad de San Andrés, Buenos Aires, and based also at University College here in London. Welcome to the program, Tanya. Of course, the top story everyone will be covering, naturally, the Nelson Mandela Memorial Service today. Some 91 heads of state, including many leaders from South America.
Yes, that's right. And I think what's striking is perhaps the variety of political affiliations of the leaders from Latin America who are going to be there today. It really shows the extent to which Mandela, even in his death, is this uniting presence. So we have from Peña Nieto, the president of Mexico, to Dilma Rousseff of Brazil, Raul Castro from Cuba will be there, and Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela has even declared 3 days of national mourning in Venezuela. Cristina Kirchner of Argentina won't be there. She has now been given the all clear to fly following her operation, but she will be deputized by Amado Boudou, who is the vice president of the country.
Okay. It's interesting, isn't it? We shouldn't really be watching anything other than, we shouldn't really be thinking, I suppose, about anything other than paying tribute to this man's life and remembering him. But of course, with that many world leaders in one place, people are interested to see what sort of interactions there might be, and thinking that Barack Obama is there as well, for example, looking at how Nicolas Maduro might or might not approach that relationship could be quite interesting, couldn't it?
It could be. I would imagine that there perhaps won't be so much personal contact in that particular scenario. I think in the case of Latin America, what's really clear is that even though Mandela is, of course, this global figure, Latin American leaders very much kind of take him on as a model for Latin America. And this is particularly on the left. So, for example, José Mujica of Uruguay has said that he's the elder brother of all social activists of our day. And in the Latin American context, that has really quite some weight. And I think, you know, if we look at the Colombian peace talks, for example, delegations on all sides have quoted Mandela, have said that he is inspiration for them getting to the table. So I think it, to a degree, in Latin America, he has a very particular resonance.
And of course, Mandela was known not to always follow protocol and reach across the aisle on both sides of the discussion point on the political spectrum. Raul Castro will be one of the many world leaders speaking at today's memorial service. Do we know whether Castro will make a political statement, perhaps, about the role of communism in Cuba? Or do you think it will be very much a personal opportunity to speak to the world?
It's hard to tell. I think, you know, he has already said that one of the reasons that he's very keen to be there is because Mandela did not follow in line with the United States when they were criticizing Cuba. So no doubt there will be a political dimension, but hopefully and perhaps there will be also a more personal message along with that.
OK, well, let's move on to other news from South America, and we'll start in Argentina, if we can, which is hitting an important anniversary.
That's right. Today is the 30th anniversary of formal redemocratization in Argentina. And I think it's a day of both celebration and somber reflection, but perhaps more of the latter today, given the mass police protests that are taking place up and down the country. Now, these are protests over wage disputes, and there have been looting as a result, including five deaths. So it's a really difficult time in Argentina. In Buenos Aires, these protests have been contained through negotiations, and that is quite useful for the administration because their main celebratory events are going to be taking place there today. There are two particular events. So one is the formal event to which are invited the former presidents, heads of state, and their families, and high-up political leaders. And the other one is the event for the population, which will be taking place in the Plaza de Mayo, the main square in Buenos Aires. And there's expected to be up to 250,000 people. But there have already been complaints. There have been statements suggesting that these events should be cancelled, given the protests taking place. So it is a difficult day to be commemorating democracy.
And of course, those protests only going to highlight the increasing social inequality in the country. Of course, there Kirchner instituted many welfare programs to try to stave off some of that inequality. But, you know, many analysts are saying it's just not working.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's a very turbulent time for Kirchnerismo. And in a certain sense, I think there's an echo with what was taking place within Peronism 30 years ago. There was a real crisis of Peronism at that moment. It came as something as a surprise when Raúl Alfonsín, who was the first democratic president, was voted in from the Radical Civic Union Party rather than a leader from the Peronist Party. And I think there's a kind of interesting coincidental echo going on nowadays with the ruptures taking place within the Peronist Party.
OK, let's move to Venezuela. And as we've said, the leadership is going to be in South Africa. But while Nicolas Maduro is there, the clampdown on Venezuelan media is continuing. Give us the background to this.
Well, it's really come to a head over the past weekend because Venezuelans have gone to the ballot boxes. They've been voting in municipal elections. And the opposition candidate, Enrique Capriles, previously, so if we look at the presidential elections in April, was flanked by media. But this weekend, he's been joined by a much leaner group of journalists. And there's been suggestions that this has been down to a campaign of intimidation by the government. And this isn't new. This weekend is not the first instance of it, but it's something that's certainly come to a head. In the last 9 months, there's been a 56% increase in reports of censorship and cases of harassment reported to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. So this is a really mass-scale phenomenon that we're talking about.
And also the sale of several media organizations that were once very critical of Maduro, now much more on his side, you could say. This has all come down to the economy, though, as one of the key issues in the country. An interesting thing I was reading there, of course, the bolivar, the currency in the country, has been in essentially a free fall. And the government actually went as far over the weekend to block websites that track the currency exchange rates.
Yeah, and more than that, this kind of cyber crackdown has seen not only currency tracking websites censored, but also Bitly, which is the website that allows the shortening of website addresses. And the Bitly allows the circumvention of the blocks to some of these sites. And so it's also being cracked down upon, which is a really interesting demonstration of the extent to which the administration is very keen to block out any kind of transparency regarding what the economic situation is looking like.
We've seen in other parts of the world that clampdowns on media like this can have the desired effect, i.e. a sort of depriving an issue of oxygen, but it can also inflame things very dramatically. And Capriles has obviously gotten an enormous amount of national exposure this year. So, I mean, which way is this one going to go? Is this creating a storm of protest?
I think it's perhaps getting more attention outside Venezuela than inside. And I think in terms of Capriles in the future, you know, he did really remarkably well in the presidential elections, given the circumstances, given his newness to the campaign. And therefore, I think, you know, if we think a bit longer term, there is potential for him to perform even better. And I think he does have a lot of support from Venezuelans outside Venezuela as well, who will be able to contribute to his campaign in meaningful ways over the next few years.
Tanya Filer, thank you very much for joining us to run through the day's news agenda as you see it this morning.
Up next, after this very short break, we'll be finding out whether U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel will be able to win over any friends on a trip to Pakistan. Just don't hold your breath.
Italy's motor city has long suffered from being painted with a very grey brush. However, as Monocle Films finds out, Turin's industrial heritage is providing inspiration to spur on a booming community of designers.
The connections to the past are everywhere in the city, but they seem to add authenticity and value to the output of the clusters of design studios that are opening. And if you look closely, you'll see a city with a deep respect for design.
Drive and ambition in Turin. In the Films menu on Monocle.com.
The perfect way to start the day on the East Coast or in Latin America, your lunchtime catch-up in Europe, The Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced news and business show, bringing you up to speed with all the day's biggest stories.
It is absolutely vast. It's palatial in its proportions, this building, and it really reflects just how important the role of Mayor of Paris is.
Monocle's team of in-house experts bring you all the latest news on media and aviation, defence and technology, while an editor is on hand to run through the morning's front pages from Bogota to Boston.
You have all these people scrambling, you have all these investigators involved, and we still don't have a clear reason as to why these batteries did what they did.
My feeling is that politicians eat and try to enrich themselves and tax us.
That's The Briefing, every weekday at midday in London and 7 a.m. in New York, in association with BlackBerry.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now, this week, an American defence secretary had his feet on the ground in Pakistan for the first time in almost 4 years. And Chuck Hagel didn't travel all that way to tell Nawaz Sharif, he pronounced his name properly, I suspect, how well he thought their alliance was going. Pakistan is one of the USA's most complicated relationships, of course, and in the last 8 weeks, it got harder still.
Now, the killing of the leader of the Taliban in Pakistan at the beginning of November, was on paper a big win for the US, but in practice, it triggered a wave of protests in the country. Now, it seems that sections of the population are losing patience with the US over its use of drone strikes, and those protests are threatening supply lines over the border with Afghanistan. So, what did Hagel's visit achieve, if anything, at all? Well, joining us now is the regional specialist and journalist Samira Shackle. Samira, thanks for joining us here on Midori House. A very brief trip for Hagel to Pakistan. Did he achieve anything?
Well, I think it's sort of a statement of intent in a way that Pakistan's just appointed a new army chief. And I think Hagel and the rest of the US administration is quite keen to shore up a good relationship with the new army general. It's such a, as you said, it's a complicated relationship between the US and Pakistan, but it is a crucial one. And particularly that military relationship is really important as the US prepares to pull out of Afghanistan next year. So I think apart from anything else, it's just to sort of make sure that this guy's on side, as it were. As you say, there's also a lot of tension about drones. There's this big question mark about what Pakistan is going to do once the US pulls out of Afghanistan. And also, yeah, I think it is quite a statement, just the fact that he's gone there, even though it was quite a whistle-stop tour. It's the first time that a US defense secretary has made a trip to Pakistan since Osama bin Laden was killed nearly 4 years ago.
Okay. I mean, you could view this as the US and Pakistan on this drone issue essentially disagreeing about what the right way to fight terror is, whether or not it's to use these drone strikes or to use more diplomatic sort of on the ground means. I suppose that's a pretty fundamental disagreement, isn't it?
Yeah, it is quite, and I think absolutely that is what it is, and I mean, it's also I think points to the fact that, I mean, that the attention now is on the disagreement between the Pakistan government and the US government on how to fight terrorism. There's also a disagreement between the Pakistan military and the Pakistan government, because a lot of the military actually favour drone strikes because they take out the top leadership of the Taliban, they make it easier to fight on the ground. But it's sort of become a real political issue. And as you say, I think it's all very tied up in this question of sovereignty as well. You mentioned earlier, Phil, about the sort of widespread anger when the Taliban leader was killed. And that's not coming from a place of support for the Taliban leader. It's this sort of attitude of, well, he's our terrorist, so we'll kill him. So don't you come here and kill our terrorists. That sort of question of sovereignty and rights.
And the Americans getting very angry as well at the blocking of very important supply routes into Afghanistan from Pakistanis. Of course, the Americans sending billions of dollars every year in aid to the country. Congressional support in Washington could potentially be waning if the Pakistanis don't necessarily change their game anytime soon.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's something that Hagel said. I mean, both sides have been quite tight-lipped about what was actually said on Monday at the meeting. But that is one thing that the Pentagon have sort of released, that they implied that this military aid, and it's a lot of military aid, $1.2 billion since last July, could be halted if this problem isn't addressed. And I think it's quite important, though, to note that it's not sort of central government policy blocking that supply route. That's sort of coming from protests, which are encouraged by local politicians. Mm-hmm. Imran Khan, namely, who's sort of the governor of that province, has threatened mass protests to stop the supply routes as a sort of leverage against drones if necessary. But Nawaz Sharif, the prime minister, has reportedly given guarantees that he's going to do everything in his power to stop that.
So is it more of a domestic political issue for Sharif versus a bilateral relationship or concerns between the Americans and the Pakistanis? Is it really just him trying to placate his domestic base?
I think it's a bit of both, really. It's quite a tricky position for Nawaz Sharif because it wasn't just Imran Khan who, during the election campaign this year, was very anti-drones. I mean, Nawaz Sharif was also on a very anti-drones package. Let's not forget, he's a sort of conservative nationalist politician. In his last premiership, he really put the backs of the Americans up by testing nuclear warheads and so on. So he's really staked a lot on ending the drones program, as has Imran Khan. And he's sort of at risk of, in terms of his domestic base, being outplayed by Khan, who's actually sort of taking action, threatening these mass protests and so on. But on the other hand, he really does have to keep this this relationship with the US going. I mean, complicated as it is, and point scoring as it might be to sort of US bash, it's can't really just be abandoned, really.
But at the same time, it's point scoring, I'm sure, is a temptation, but it's a uniquely sort of strong position that Pakistan finds itself in now, I suppose, given what's happening in Afghanistan with the withdrawal of US and UK troops next year. So this is a potentially a moment of opportunity as well for Nawaz Sharif.
Yeah, I think it is. It's just quite difficult, I think, for him to know how to play the hand. Because I think they don't really want to lose this influx of cash from the US. And there's also the fact that that chaos in Afghanistan will mean chaos in Pakistan. So I think it's in a stable Afghanistan is in everyone's interest, really. But it's sort of what that stable Afghanistan will look like and what different elements of the Pakistani state, from the military, the intelligence services, the government, want that stable Afghanistan to look like.
Samira, excellent stuff. Thanks very much for joining us here on the program. Journalist Samira Shackel there on the US Defense Secretary's visit to Pakistan. Up next, we'll be in Greece to find out why there's more bad news for that country's economy.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
London, to my Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London.
London, Europe top.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
Welcome back to the programme, and it is time to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. That correspondent right now is Natalie Savarakas, who is our woman in Athens. Natalie, welcome back to the programme. So first up, the ever elusive deal with Greece's creditors. It's fallen behind again.
Indeed, the international inspectors were expected to come to Athens. They actually arrived today, although until recently everyone here were sitting on the edge of their seats because it appeared that they might not be coming, as just a deal is seeming even more elusive, as you mentioned. And now, although they're coming, the Eurozone finance ministers that were meeting yesterday said it was very unlikely for the inspectors and the Greek authorities to reach any sort of deal by the end of the year. And that's essentially because Athens has failed to make the requisite progress.
But Athens, just to be the optimist here, there does seem to be some progress on the economy in Greece. They were able to pass the 2014 budget, which will show that the country is going to return to growth next year, something like 0.6% growth in 2014. So this must be some good news, no?
Oh, absolutely, and I'm glad you mentioned it. Indeed, I mean, on Saturday night, the state managed to, despite its way, the government, despite its wafer-thin parliamentary majority, managed to push through a very controversial state budget that included 3.1 billion euros of state spending cuts and 2.5 billion euros of additional tax revenue. What also we've seen is, thanks to all this, we've had financial agencies that have upgraded Greece's status because they foresee a primary balance for this year, including record surpluses for next year. Nonetheless, it seems that it's not enough to convince the country's international creditors because Athens was supposed to fulfill some 135 commitments for the successful conclusion of its autumn review, and yet so far it's only achieved 60 of these commitments, and it seems that the progress is getting slower day by day.
Natalie, let's go from economics to politics. Very much connected in this case, though. We're talking about the far-right party Golden Dawn, which some sort of battle has been going on over its reputation very publicly.
Yes, indeed. What we're having now is the prosecutors that are desperately trying to build a case against the party. I remind you that in September, one of their members stabbed a hip-hop artist. That essentially precipitated the crackdown of the authorities against the party. Its leader now is behind bars, and now the police recently has been raiding the homes of its members, its MPs. The police has recently confiscated mobile phones, hard disks, SIM cards, data storage sticks, all this in efforts to unveil, if you like, the true nature of the party, which many, of course, accuse it of being a staunch neo-Nazi party with a very violently anti-immigrant and very violent streaks. Nonetheless, it seems that the party is refuting everything. Now, the latest that has surfaced is photos of party members dressed in Ku Klux Klan gowns, saluting in Nazi-style salutes. But, of course, the spokesman yesterday came out on its party website saying that this was all part of a party, a carnival party, where they were all wearing fancy dress. And that is essentially to see if the Greek public and Golden Dawn supporters will actually believe the authorities or this extreme right party. And at the moment, the polls are very much showing that Golden Dawn has garnered this past popularity.
And finally, Nelly, just one last story for us. And an interesting video that's circulating across the Greek media. And it shows a couple of interesting things. And one of them including a young toddler who seems to be running around wearing a balaclava. What's happening?
Well, indeed, what it is essentially a video circulating. It's high school students from the very alternative bohemian neighborhood of the district of Exarchia, which is in central Athens. It was actually it's a stomping ground for anarchists. It's where many popular uprisings have started from, including the uprising against the junta of the 70s. But lately, Greeks have stereotyped it. There are many taboos that surface from there, and the police crackdown against this neighborhood has been very fierce, including this past Friday, where tons of tear gas were sprayed against protesters that were quite aggressive, if you like, as well, in commemorating the death of a young kid in 2008 by policemen. Now, what this video is trying to portray is essentially young high school students that are saying, hey, this is where we live. You know, what everyone knows in Greece about Exarchia is not all about Molotov cocktails, anarchy, and just an aggressive bunch of residents. We are here, we have dreams, and perhaps you Greeks out there who just don't see us as, you know, who just see us with all these stereotypes should take a better look at us. We have dreams and we're just regular kids having a good time.
Natalie, thanks very much for joining us here on the program. Monocle's Athens correspondent, Natalie Savarkis.
In the next half hour of the programme, we'll unpick a dramatic bit of media power play in Russia. We'll also flip through this morning's newspapers. And we also will give our correspondent Barrett Austin a plum assignment, winter in Miami.
Tech Design Miami is unique in the sense that it's the only fair entirely dedicated to collectible design and really covering the entire spectrum of the 20th and the 21st century.
Barrett's report a little later. First, Paul Osborne with your headlines.
In half an hour's time, a memorial service for Nelson Mandela will begin at a giant stadium near Soweto. Huge crowds have gathered there to remember South Africa's first black president. Thousands queued through the night in the hope of getting a seat inside the stadium. Dozens of world leaders and other dignitaries are to attend, including President Obama and the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Two French soldiers have been killed in the Central African Republic. They were shot dead just a few days after France stepped up its deployment in the country in response to a surge in violence. In Thailand, the country's prime minister has appealed to anti-government demonstrators to play a part in February's snap elections. Yingluck Shinawatra dissolved parliament on Monday after sustained protests against her, but she's rejecting demands that she stand down immediately, saying she'll remain as caretaker prime minister until the poll takes place. The mayor of the Colombian capital, Bogotá, has been sacked and banned from holding public office for the next 15 years. Gustavo Petro is a former member of an armed rebel group. He says he's the victim of a coup designed to stop him standing for president next year. And the president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, is to hold talks with his three predecessors to try to end the protests against his government. Last week, the three men had backed the demonstrators who'd taken to the streets after a trade deal with the European Union was abandoned in favour of maintaining closer ties with Russia. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Paul. It's 33 minutes past the hour here in London. Paul, we'll be back at the top of the hour with another check of your world headlines. But in the meantime, you're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. Now, even by Russian standards of disdain for the Fourth Estate, it was a shock. President Vladimir Putin has today dissolved the state-owned news agency RIA Novosti and effectively handed it over to control of one of his most ardent supporters.
New director Putin appointed for the new company, to be known as Rossiya Segodnya, is Dmitry Kiselev, an ultra-conservative television anchor. To explain this surprise move a bit earlier, Monocle's Andrew Muller and Ted Kravitz were joined in the studio by Ben Judah. He's author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Also on the phone was Monocle's Vienna contributor Alexei Korolev, who used to work for RIA Novosti himself, no less. But first, here's Ben.
Well, RIA Novosti is a very old and established Russian news agency. The original news agency that it grew out of was established in 1941 as the Soviet press agency, and it has long been Russia's best international news outfit with correspondents in 40 countries, producing high-quality stuff. And it's important to say that not everyone in the Russian state and not everyone in the Russian state over the past 10 years shares Putin's increasingly radical direction of propaganda. And during the years where Dmitry Medvedev was officially the president of Russia, RIA Novosti had a huge injection of cash. It was encouraged to go out, produce better, high-quality stories at a Reuters standard in English, in the hope that countries that Russia was trying to influence in Africa, Central Asia, and the Middle East would buy their copy because it was a bargain basement prices compared to Reuters or AP, as a way for competing internationally with big, serious players in the international news market, such as new powers that are emerging in China and with the old classic press agencies. However, this meant that RIA Novosti has always been viewed by members of Putin's increasingly radical inner circle as being a Medvedev project. Mm. And if you read RIA Novosti's work closely, I read it very, very closely because it was of such high standard, you would find yourself reading a very accurate reporting of the Pussy Riot trial, very accurate reporting of the protest movement, very accurate reporting of some of the more shameful aspects of Russia's political present. And you would catch yourself thinking, if the country gets even more authoritarian, this is not going to last. And duly, it hasn't. Hmm.
The messenger being shot there. I want to bring in Alexei Korolev now, our correspondent in Moscow. You used to work for RIA Novosti. What was it like as a place to be a journalist?
Yeah, well, hello, first of all. I was working there at RIA Novosti during those Medvedev years when we witnessed that injunction of cash, as Benji said there. Well, it was fun. It was a jolly good time, actually, because Medvedev fancied himself as a liberal, or at least liberal-minded. I mean, he was certainly the first Russian leader to go online and posting pictures of his pet cat on his Twitter account and so on. And so we, and especially the foreign language desks, I was on the English language newswire, we were free, and sometimes inordinately so, in what we could report. Now, of course, there was a certain amount of content that was sort of dictated to us from above, if you will, but it was usually some nonsense promoting Russian sailing boats on a mission to conquer the high seas or such like. So nobody really took that seriously. Now, to be fair, the Russian language service wasn't and isn't blatant propaganda either. That is, not compared to other state media like the Tartas News Agency, for instance. But from what I heard and from what I know, reporters and newsroom writers on the Russian service were certainly a lot more restricted in their work and their opinions than we were. But there came a point, for me personally as well, when things started to go sour. Benji said that RIA Novosti was largely a Medvedev project. And when Vladimir Putin indicated that he wanted sort of to go back to power, when Putin and Medvedev announced in September 2011 that they had decided to swap roles, it was a turn for the worse. But then, of course, the pro-democracy protests broke out in December 2011. And we all gladly joined in, of course. And for a moment there, it all seemed like a bright new dawn of a bright new era. But very, very shortly afterwards, in the run-up to the presidential election that Putin was, of course, to win, and in the months after that, it became clear that whatever freedom we had enjoyed at RIA Novosti was gone. And just to give you an idea, I had a couple of articles pulled from the website for overt criticism of Kremlin policies during that time, and a number of former colleagues had similar problems. Nothing amounting to Soviet-like censorship, of course, but the uncomfortable feeling was there. And on one or two occasions, again, we sort of received corporate emails advising against covering certain topics like the Sochi Olympics, in critical light, that is, or criticizing certain Kremlin policies.
Ben, coming back to you in the studio, the other part of Vladimir Putin's decree today is that he's also axed the voice of Russia, the international radio station. Did anyone actually still listen to that, or was it just a Cold War relic?
Actually, there were listeners to that station, and you would be surprised of the amount of listeners to Russian media, Russia Today, the voice of Russia, in the Muslim world, where it is believed, not entirely incorrectly, that it offers a different focus and perspective from American news channels. But just to come back to Mr. Kisilyov, you could not have picked a worse person, a more repellent person to project Russia's image abroad.
Sounds like
his TV show is not just a discussion show, but it's the equivalent of the 10 Minutes Hate in 1984, where he projects an image of the West as sexual perversion, rampant homosexuality, which he equates with disease and the degeneration of civilization, and that this man will be projected using, have a whole news agency to himself to project an image of Russia which is homophobic, violent, Islamophobic, crypto-anti-Semitic, is a disaster for Russia's image abroad. And it brings us back to an interesting point. So why would you project your country like this? Why would you choose to make your turn your country into a bogeyman in the West? Well, that's exactly it, because by turning yourself into the bogeyman in the West, you can drum up support at home by making Russia feel even more embattled and encircled than it is already.
And in 10 seconds, is this a done deal, or is this unchangeable now?
Well, the actual composition of what this new agency is we're not 100% sure. Anyway. Like, we don't know how many people will be sacked, how many people won't be sacked. We don't know the exact power dynamics within it.
That was our Vienna correspondent there, Alexei Korolev, and Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, speaking to Monocle's Andrew Muller and Ted Kravitz.
It certainly was. You're listening to Midori House. We're going to be in Miami after the break. Phil is going to trail it for you. Tease us, Phil.
It's time to get on your speedos, gentlemen. We're going to Miami.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's in Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
Cityscapes have inspired filmmakers for generations, and this year we sent a film crew to the Architecture Film Festival in Rotterdam to explore common themes found in building real and imaginary worlds.
In film, you can tell what's behind the walls. You can tell about the conflicts people have, the social aspects. And as filmmakers, in essence, are interested more or less in those conflicts, you can tell what's behind the facade.
Passion, obsession, idealism, architecture on film. Now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Phil Hahn. The time here in London is 8:42 a.m. Now, with annual editions in Basel and Miami Beach, Design Miami has carved out its place as the world's leading forum for exhibiting collectible design from the 20th and 21st centuries.
And whereas fairs like Salone di Mobile in Milan are all about taking the pulse of the world's leading manufacturers, Design Miami has its sights set firmly on highlighting individual designers, both the historical and the emerging.
Well, we sent Monocle's Barrett Austin along for this week's Section D. Here's a snippet of what he discovered.
Ever since launching in 2005, Design Miami has earned a place among the world's most important forums for design, culture, and commerce. Now in its ninth year, the fair has grown larger than ever before. This year, the first week of December saw 37 hand-picked exhibitors and more than 30,000 attendees descend on Miami for the week-long event. As a partner fair occurring alongside Art Basel, there's a clear synergy between Design Miami and all the satellite art world events, though it's unique in its focus on the functional object. Marianne Goebel has been the fair's director since 2011. Under her watch, Design Miami has expanded its range of programming and firmed up its spot as one of the world's top forums for exhibiting, collecting, and discussing 20th and 21st century design. As we sat under an outdoor pavilion designed by Brooklyn-based Formless Finder, I ask Goebel how the fair differentiates itself from other global design forums.
The Design Miami is unique in the sense that it's the only fair entirely dedicated to collectible design and really covering the entire spectrum of the 20th and the 21st century. Milan, the Salone Satellite in April, is the meeting point for the design industry, where you can discover all the new work coming out in serial production. I would say it's the meeting point for the entire industry, while Design Miami is taking place in a different context.
The different context, Goebel points out, has everything to do with the atmosphere surrounding Art Basel and the nearly two dozen satellite events that occur alongside it. In the same way the art fairs surrounding Basel allow galleries to focus on work from single artists, a similar approach allows dealers and curators to highlight the work of individual designers, those both living and dead, in expertly curated solo shows. I asked Goebel if the increasingly common format of exhibitors focusing on a single designer perhaps offered a deeper experience for visitors.
No, absolutely. I'm personally a big fan of solo shows because it really allows you to explore in depth the body of work of a particular designer. One example this year is the Outdoor Furniture by Walter Lamb. It's outdoor furniture designed in the 1950s, and the first pieces were actually put together of tubes that were recuperated in Pearl Harbor from the sunken ships, and that then turned into a serial production of extremely elegant outdoor furniture, which I had never heard about being European. Maybe it's more well known in the US, and we've opened three hours ago, but I've heard really enthusiastic reactions from people all over the world who, like me, had never heard of him before.
While the week of Design Miami has sometimes been overshadowed by the reach of Art Basel, there's a clear impression that the fair remains a mainstay in design circles. And the range of programming and exhibitions offered throughout the week have ensured Design Miami stays relevant. I spoke with the fair's co-founder for his impressions 9 years on.
I'm Craig Robbins, CEO of DACRA and chairman of Design Miami. I'm blown away. It's our best show ever. It's nice to be part of something that is growing, becoming more mature, and also becoming more deep.
Robbins is one of the city's top developers and the man behind the city's rapidly developing design district. And he's quick to point out how fairs like this have helped alter the perceptions of a city like Miami.
Miami has transformed from being a fun in the sun kind of a city to being a global city of cultural substance. And of course, as someone who lives here and believes in the city, it's especially inspiring to me to be part of something that's meaningful.
Back outside, at the entrance to the pavilion, Marianne Goebel describes all the planning that goes into making this week become a reality. While the commercial goals of Design Miami are certainly ever-present, it seems there's more to the fair than transactions alone.
Well, we are a platform with many different players and ingredients, and ultimately we will be happy if our exhibitors are happy. I personally am happy when I have the feeling that we have a lot of visitors who are having a good time and who are obviously either finding pleasure in pieces that they know about, that, you know, the specialists that they're looking for something they know about, or design virgins who come in for the first time and discover this world and find out that actually functional objects are much more than just what they see and that they can learn and experience them.
For Monocle in Miami, I'm Barrett Austin.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London, Europe, London,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 9:48 in Rome. It's 8:48 here in London. Now, in just a moment, we'll be flicking through this morning's European front pages with Monocle's Alexa Firmenich. But before we do, here's a little Swiss music from Sophie Hunger. This is City Lights Forever.
In Berlin, there's a project waiting for all, and we're in Napoleon, cut into spalls, and I wish I were too.
A that was City Lights Forever there by Sophie Unger.
You may have heard her. She's here. Alexa Firmanich is our paper reviewer this morning, and she's going to flick through some of the morning's newspapers from Europe. Which nations are we looking at, Alexa?
She was now very excited talk. About Sophie Unger, weren't you?
I was. She's a great lady.
So, which papers are we doing today?
I'd like to start with El País. Yesterday, this airport in Ciudad Real, which is around 200 kilometers south of Madrid, went up for sale. This is one of the latest in Spain's housing and property bubble fiascos. And its bidding, original bidding price was 100 million euros, which was a tenth of the original construction cost, which was 1 billion.
Ooh, so why hasn't it worked?
Well, it was put in a town that had a very, very low amount of people, or just under 100,000 people. It wasn't a very populated, useful town. People didn't go there for any particular touristical reasons. And the town already had a high-speed railway connecting it to Madrid, which did sort of beg the question, why did they have such an ambitious airport in a city where there was, lack for such demand of a terminal in the region?
Well, how did they even let it to be built in the first place? Wouldn't common sense prevail here, you'd think?
I mean, you'd think so, but then there's another airport similar in Valencia, and they also built in Galicia, a city of culture, for hundreds of millions of euros that can be seen from space and that lies empty.
Well, I mean, you can see the dilemma there, can't you? Because on the one hand, there's the sort of emphasis on placemaking. If you think big, if you plan to do something, then the sort of economic effects will follow. But you do need to try and make sure that it's got a sort of that kind of critical mass of people willing to turn up, right?
Well, you do have to ask, how did they allow all of these projects to take place without making sure that there's going to be enough demand?
And any idea on who potentially might bid for this airport? I'm guessing it indeed won't be an airport and might be turned into something else.
Well, it's quite interesting. They say that there are no official people yet, but that there are a few potential buyers. And the way they're trying to market it is they're saying, well, this is a relatively isolated airport with good transport links. So maybe you could use this as an area for more for aircraft maintenance or long-term parking of planes and similar storage businesses.
So it's gone from this enormous, huge, world-beating ambition to a car park for planes.
Plane graveyard.
Oh, dearie me.
Maybe we could pool in our funds and make it a Monocle hub. The Monocle airport hub.
Just for Monocle staff.
Yeah, we could potentially broaden busy. Out in the future, but we could just keep it nice and intimate.
We'll send you there, Phil.
I'll put a post-it on that idea and we'll come back to it after the show, Phil.
Let me know how it goes.
Thanks. What's next, Alexa?
So next is something I'm pretty excited about. This is happening on Thursday, and it's Geneva's one of our really, really, really big national days, called L'Escalade.
Okay.
And it basically celebrates our defeat of a surprise attack by the Savoy troops on the longest night of the year. So one of the Savoy kings, wanted to make Switzerland his empire to the north of the, capital north of the Alps.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1580, and so they attacked by night.
I was about to ask you the date and you knew it.
Yes,
this is good.
I
was going to turn it into a test, but you've already passed it.
Thank you. And that evening they all attacked and they were scaling the walls of the old town of Geneva, because right then it was just on a hill with these very towering walls. And legend has it that this mother of 14, whose name was Catherine Chesnel, was cooking a big cauldron of soup, and she heard the attackers come in, and she released the cauldron onto the attackers with all the hot soup and killed one of them.
Sort of improv boiling oil.
Pretty much.
Nice.
And the commotion of which woke up the city and allowed us to defeat the attack.
So how do you celebrate this day then? Does everyone eat nice hot soup?
Better. Uh-huh. We get huge chocolate cauldrons.
Okay, obviously a chocolate cauldron. Isn't that a joke? It's like the world's most foolish invention is a chocolate cauldron.
It's really not a joke. It's a very important day for us.
But don't they melt? I mean, that's my point.
No. It's a cauldron made of chocolate, and we fill it with marzipan vegetables.
Oh, delicious.
And the oldest and the youngest in the family breaks it together and says, "Ainsi périssent les ennemis de la République." So in this way perish the enemies of the Republic.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah. So I'm very
excited
about that.
Is it actually the longest night of the year on Thursday?
I think so.
So that means winter's almost over, right?
Hey, well, that's optimistic of you, Phil, but that's good. So it is a metaphorical chocolate cauldron, not one that actually contains any hot liquids.
No,
very sensible.
No, but it's made of chocolate.
Yeah.
I love it. Okay. And of course, something that we've covered quite a bit here on Monocle 24, of course, the memorial service for Nelson Mandela, but an interesting story out of Geneva on this issue.
Yeah, I mean, this is a little bit ridiculous. The Young Socialist Party want to rename a street in Geneva after Nelson Mandela. And they actually want to rename Rue du Rhône, which is one of the most major streets in Geneva, our shopping street. And they say, oh, we want to replace these consumerist values with those that Mandela represents. I don't think it's going to happen. It's a huge process to debaptize a street. Normally you have to wait 10 years after the decease of the person. And they need to have marked Geneva's history in some really integral way.
That's a very long process.
It is. It is. But, you know, you have to take away a name of the street that's been there for decades and replace them.
Well, that's the problem. There are plenty of worthy people to be given a street name, but it's whose name's going to be stripped from one as well.
Exactly.
That's the difficulty.
In Toronto, we just make up a lot of street names. So there's like a Mike Myers Street, a Wayne Gretzky Road, I think even a Keanu Reeves Lane or something like
wow.
that.
A Wayne Gretzky Road,
yeah.
really?
Yeah.
That's extraordinary.
Well, then we can
there's
expect Mandela Road soon. No.
Well, there are plenty in East London here in the UK. We'll see if it follows there. Alexa, thank you very much. Always nice to see you. And that is all we have time for on today's programme, as you can hear from the music rising behind my voice. Thanks to producer Daniel Giacopelli, our researchers Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Luis Mendoza, and our studio manager Alex Funnell. What's up next, Phil?
Up next was Monocle's weekly food and drink show hosted by Marcus Hippie. It is The Menu. I hope you're hungry. Stay tuned for the briefing at midday London time, 7 a.m. in New York. Georgina Godwin and Tyke Enright will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But from me, Phil Hahn.
And me, Dominic Reynolds. It's goodbye and thank you very much for listening.
From London
to Zurich
to New York
to Hong Kong
to Beijing
nach Amsterdam
to Bogota.
This is Monocle 24.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness. A witness to words that moved nations. It's dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time. It tells history. Rolex.